The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email us, send the email to td@kpcg.fm. Hopefully, by the end of this week, we can run through some more listener response. Well, I'd like to begin the program by just giving you an abbreviated list of some of the jihadist attacks from just this year alone, 2015. What a year this has been. It started off, you had the Charlie Hebdo attack, or Hebdo, in January, followed by the Islamist attack on that Jewish market in Paris, just a day or two later, I believe. That killed four. Charlie Hebdo, I think 12 people died in that attack. And really, as bad as that was, it was nowhere near what happened in Nigeria, this massacre carried out by Boko Haram on the unarmed village. At least several hundred were murdered, but some Nigerian officials estimate that 2,000 people were shot dead by this terrorist group that just worked their way through a small unarmed village, killing everybody in sight. If you look at any list of terrorist attacks for the year, there's just all sorts of car bombings, suicide bombings in Libya, in Nigeria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria. Boko Haram, really, if you just look at that one group alone. All sorts of attacks in Africa, Nigeria, Cameroon. There was one in February that killed 90 civilians, I believe. We're probably more familiar with some of the ones that happened in the West. The two shootings in Denmark. I think that was February or March. One of them aimed at Jews. The other one aimed at critics of Islam. And then who can forget some of the more infamous videos that surfaced this year, that Japanese journalist beheaded by ISIS, the Jordanian pilot who was burned alive inside of that cage, and then the 21 Coptic Christians beheaded on that beach in Libya. In March, there was the attack on the Bardo Museum in Tunisia. That killed 21 people. An attack on a museum, just a museum. Lots of these attacks come on museums, hotels, universities, shopping malls. Al-Shabaab, they attacked a hotel in March. They killed 24 people. That same group killed 147 at a university in Kenya in April. This is all just this year. Most of the victims in that April attack in Kenya were Christians. Boko Haram attacked another helpless village in April, killing 24. In the States, there were quite a few headlines in May with that shooting at the Muhammad Art exhibit in Garland, Texas. And then really all through the summer, whether Boko Haram, ISIS, Al-Shabaab. In June, there was the attack in Tunisia again. That Islamist gunman who just walked his way down the beach, killing 38 people. Most of those victims were British. And then over the summer, of course, you have the really the mass genocide of Christians all across the Middle East and North Africa, the Yazidi communities. And then, of course, the sex slavery, sexual enslavement of women and little girls in Iraq, in Syria. There was a report on NBC earlier this year about ISIS as it worked its way through Iraq, killing off the men, beheading them, and then the women were sold into slavery, sometimes many times over, suffering all kinds of unimaginable acts of brutality. And then more recently, we've had all these reports from Jerusalem, the knife attacks, the axe attacks, the vehicular rammings, automobiles just smashing into civilians. And then last week, you have the multiple shootings and bombings around Paris, killing 129 people. This is the world that we live in. These are terrible times in so many different ways. This is not God's world. As Herbert Armstrong said in Mystery of the Ages, this world is not God's world, and of that we may be thankful. It's now in its very last days. This world is in its last days, and we can be thankful for that. I want to take you through Carolyn Glick's latest column. I've been waiting for this basically since the attack on Friday night, anxious to see what she had to say. She's an Israeli columnist, by the way, living there in Israel. And she writes about radical Islam, the invisible enemy. This is from November 17th, just yesterday. And she begins her article by referring to the Democratic Party debate last Saturday night. This would have been the day after that massacre in Paris, when you had these Democrats led by Hillary Clinton who want to be the next president of the United States. And in this particular clip I'll play for you here in a second, the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, she talks here about just how difficult it is to understand what motivates the jihadists. Here's what she said.
I think with this kind of barbarism and nihilism, it's very hard to understand, other than the lust for power, the rejection of modernity, the total disregard for human rights, freedom, or any other value that we know and respect.
This kind of barbarism, it's very difficult, very hard, she says, to understand. And Carolyn Glick says, of course, it's easy to understand what motivates Islamic terrorists. They tell us all the time. They want the world to be run by an Islamic empire. When they're in charge, they will kill, subjugate, convert, or enslave all non-Muslims, except Jews. The Jews will be obliterated. The attacks they carry out in the Western world are viewed both as battles for the soul of Muslims worldwide and as a means to terrorize non-Muslims into accepting subjugation. We talked a little bit yesterday about how that these attacks are aimed at drawing in more recruits from the Muslim world. And then also, they're used as a means to, as she says there, terrorize non-Muslims into accepting subjugation. Now, this is not what Carolyn Glick thinks about radical Islam. This is what radical Islam itself proclaims to the world, as she said there. We can very quickly understand and know what motivates them. They tell us. They tell us all the time. Now, there's two different competing schools of thought within the world of radical Islam, as she brings out in her article. You have the Sunni version that wants an Islamic empire, an Islamic caliphate. And then you have the Shiite version, which also wants an Islamic empire. It just wants it to be ruled by an Ayatollah in Tehran. She says, the radical Islamic goal of destroying America and the rest of the world is the same, regardless of who ends up winning the intramural jihad contest. Well, we know who will win it. Iran is the king. Iran's the prophesied king of the South. But she brings up a good point in that the aim for both sides, for both these competing schools, is the same. An Islamic empire. This is not hard to understand. They tell us this repeatedly. She writes, and as we have seen repeatedly in recent years, the sides are happy to come together to achieve their common goal of killing us and destroying our societies. Now, well, at least before last Friday, you had many Western leaders who were quite happy to ignore this reality and to excuse and justify many of these acts of terror, even after the jihadists beheaded that British soldier back in 2013, the British Prime Minister, Mr. Cameron, David Cameron. This was, I think, the day after that horrific event, which was also, much of it, caught on film. The day after that happened, you have the Prime Minister here in the UK rising in defense of Islam. Here's what the Prime Minister had to say.
This was not just an attack on Britain and on the British way of life. It was also a betrayal of Islam and of the Muslim communities who give so much to our country. There is nothing in Islam that justifies this truly dreadful act.
That's what he said soon after that British soldier was beheaded right on the streets of London. Now you go back to Paris, the Charlie Hebdo attack in January, a smaller scale now compared to what happened last week. But even after that attack in January, the French president, Francois Hollande, he also said that these attackers that carried out those attacks on that magazine facility, as well as the Jewish market, that it had nothing to do with Islam. Nothing to do with Islam. That's been heard over and over again from Western officials. And maybe that's changed in a dramatic way over the past week. We've talked about that yesterday and the day before. But let me just take you back to an article we quoted from this in a video we produced earlier in the year. It's from The Atlantic, from the March 2015 edition by Graham Wood. And he says, virtually every major decision, he's talking about ISIS here, and the religious component to this movement, virtually every major decision and law promulgated by the Islamic State adheres to what it calls, in its press and pronouncements, and on its billboards, license plates, stationery, and coins, the prophetic methodology, which means following the prophecy and the example of Muhammad in punctilious detail. See, it's not hard, to figure out what motivates them, as Carolyn Glick said. They tell us. They tell us all the time. It's in the press, it's in their pronouncements, it's on billboards, it's on their license plates, stationery, coins. They follow the prophecy and the example of Muhammad. It says here Muslims can reject the Islamic State, nearly all do, but pretending that it isn't actually a religious millenarian group with theology that must be understood to be combated has already led the United States to underestimate it and back foolish schemes to counter it. All these attacks, one after another after another. And Western leaders, especially the one heading up the United States, rushing to the defense of Islam. Well, now there are those in Europe who are waking to the fact that these attacks have been carried out by religious zealots, for sure. Coming back to Carolyn Glick's article, she says here, rather than develop comprehensive plans for dealing with this enemy, the Americans, the Europeans, and others have opted for a mix of policies running the spectrum from appeasement to whack-a-mole operations. Abroad, appeasement has taken its most significant form in the U.S.-led nuclear deal with Iran. As the largest state sponsor of terrorism and the most active radical Islamic imperialist force in the Middle East, let me repeat that. This is Iran. As the largest state sponsor of terrorism and the most active radical Islamic imperialist force in the Middle East, Iran is the ground zero of radical Islam. We've been telling you this for 20 years. Iran is ground zero for radical Islam. It not only oversees and directs the operations of its puppets, like Syrian President Bashar Assad, and its foreign legions like Hezbollah. It says further on, the Iranian regime has also played a key role in developing Muslim Brotherhood offshoots, like Al-Qaeda, which received and likely continues to receive training and direction from Iran's Revolutionary Guards. As for the Islamic State, I want you to take note of this last comment here. She says, as for Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, if Iran had been interested in preventing its rise, Islamic State would never have taken over any territory in either country. That's a true statement. Upon leaving, as you know, the U.S., the United States effectively, upon leaving Iraq, I should say, the United States effectively handed the nation over to Iran, as we've said so many times. And I think what's interesting with what's happened over the last week, you have a lot of conservative commentators talking about just how easy it would be for the United States, having all this awesome power, how easy it would be for the United States if it just had the will to go in there and to squash this Islamic State movement. Well, the same could be said for Iran. Iran has the power. It has the capability of absolutely obliterating this Islamic State movement. And if Iran had been interested in doing this, or in preventing the rise of the Islamic State, it would have done so. Let me take you back to February and remind you here of what Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, said at a Jewish conference. This was the remarks he made leading up to the much-publicized speech that he gave at U.S. Congress. And in this speech, he's explaining why, you know, there are a lot of critics saying that he shouldn't go and speak at Congress and that this was some kind of a political move on his part. And in this speech, he explains why he was going forward with this speech before Congress. And then in the midst of that explanation, here's what he said about Iran.
I think the pursuit of nuclear weapons by Iran is the most urgent security challenge facing the world. I think the greatest danger facing humanity is the possibility that any movement or any regime of militant Islam will arm itself with the weapons of mass destruction. Everything that we see in our region now will pale by comparison. Everything that we see in Europe will pale by comparison. When a militant Islamic regime that is rampaging through the region right now, that's what Iran is doing. It's conducting a rampage through the region. When such a regime has nuclear weapons, the whole world will be in peril. Look at what Iran is doing now without nuclear weapons. States are collapsing, and Iran is plunging forward. It's already controlling four capitals.
Now, we talked about some of these comments in our publications on the website at thetrumpet.com. This rampage through the region. And, of course, since he gave this speech, Mr. Netanyahu, you have the deal between the West, led by the United States, the deal with Iran, which clears the way for them to pursue a nuclear weapon. Now imagine just how dangerous these radical Islamist movements would be. The little moles that continually are squashed by the West, and then another one pops up. Imagine how dangerous some of these movements would be if they had a nuclear weapon. A few months ago, again, this takes us back to some of the things that we drew attention to in our publications and videos earlier this year. This is from the Lebanese site, Now, by Michael Young. He wrote in March, I believe, the reality is that during the last decade, Iran has been actively pushing for fragmentation of the Arab world. What's the rationale? Quite simply, that an Arab world deeply divided, shattered into sectarian entities, and weakened, represents fertile ground for Iran to impose its hegemony regionally. Now, here again, consider what Carolyn Glick wrote just yesterday. If Iran was interested in preventing the rise of Islamic State, it would have prevented it. But it works to its advantage. It works in the favor of Iran to have all these competing ideologies within the radical Islamist movement. All of them want to wipe out the West. All of them want an Islamic State. And it works to their advantage when all of these sectarian groups take out Western targets. A fractious Arab world only strengthens Iran's position. Mr. Netanyahu brought that out in the speech that clip you just heard. Here it is, rampaging through the region. Michael Young continued, the Iranians are more than willing to allow the United States and the Arab states to bombard ISIS. Now, this is from earlier in the year. And think about this now in the context of what's happened more recently. And to think about the bombardment that France and other nations in Europe, Russia perhaps, think about the hit that ISIS is going to take. It says the Iranians are more than willing to allow the United States and the Arab states to bombard ISIS, as the group represents an irritant in that it straddles vital Iranian supply lines between Iraq and Syria. But ISIS hardly represents a strategic threat to Iran. On the contrary, by drawing Western attention to the terrorist problem, it distracts Western governments from Iran's larger project in the Middle East. It distracts Western nations from the king. It's a huge distraction. Now, ISIS is through and through. It's a horrible, horrible movement bent on evil sexual slavery, wiping out entire Yazidi or Christian communities. But the point that Carolyn Glick makes in her column is that whether it's ISIS, whether it's Al-Qaeda, it doesn't much matter. They all have similar aims. And they're all motivated by radical Islamist theology. Back to Carolyn Glick. She says, the West's whack-a-mole war against radical Islam at home and abroad has meant that even as one group, like core al-Qaeda, is cut down, it's swiftly replaced by other groups, like Islamic State. And if IS is eventually cut down, it too will be replaced by another group, and then reconstitute itself as IS when the West's attention is taken up by the next major group. President Obama has enabled this state of affairs by defining the enemy as narrowly as possible, reducing the whole sphere of radical Islam to a few secrete groups like al-Qaeda and IS that he seeks to defeat or contain. She says here, it's not simply that the whack-a-mole strategy doesn't work, it's self-defeating. Since the radical Islamic trigger pullers in the West are usually no more than a few people who get together to murder people, insisting that someone has to be a card-carrying member of a recognized terror group before authorities will go after him, makes it almost impossible to find operatives and to prevent attacks. In other words, there's no solution to this, not with this kind of strategy. And so things are going to change, particularly in Europe. It's building, as we've said this week, it's building to a spectacular clash. The Bible prophesies of this. Glick here is just highlighting why this movement, this radical Islamist movement, is growing. It's gaining momentum. It's hardly contained. She says, while Friday's killers may have given their allegiance to IS, they were operationally and ideologically all but indistinguishable from their predecessors in the London subways in 2005 and the Madrid commuter rails in 2004, who hailed from al-Qaeda. Likewise, while the U.S. may have seriously degraded core al-Qaeda in the Middle East over the past 7 years, Islamic State in Iraq, Syria, Egypt, and Libya is an organic extension of al-Qaeda. To defeat these groups, the U.S. and its allies need to adopt a strategy that is rooted in an acknowledgement of the nature of our true enemy, radical Islam. See, these are root causes. This is the nature of the enemy. Certainly not all Muslims, as you've heard over and over and over again, are like these violent, violent extremists. But you have to get to root causes. Where is it? Where is it that they get their motivation from? Well, listen to what they say. Listen to what they tell us. She says the most important component of Friday night's massacre was the terrorist radical Islamic motivation. That's the most important component of that massacre Friday night. And Europe is beginning to wake up to that fact. As the Bible prophesies, at the time of the end, the King of the South is going to push. It's going to push at the King of the North. It's going to push at Europe. And Europe, the Bible says, shall come against it like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, ships, and so on. God says there's going to be a clash in this end time, at the time of the end, between the kings of the north and south. These same two forces that have gone against each other throughout history for centuries. These crusades, Catholic Europe, radical Islam, history is repeating itself. And through it all, of course, God says to you and to me that our fight Our wrestling match is not against flesh and blood, not against human beings, but against spiritual wickedness or wicked spirits in high places. Let me just take you through a couple of verses in Revelation 12 before we conclude this segment. But look, we're entering into a time of crisis. And you run down the list, and I just gave you at the start of this segment, I gave you a very short list, an abbreviated list, an abridged list of what man has been doing to man. What happens when you put more powerful weapons, more destructive weapons, in the hands of some of these most radical, extreme killers? Well, look at Revelation 12 here, and verse 9. It says, "The great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." He was cast out, it says there. He's deceived the whole, he was cast into this earth. He's confined to this earth, as my father's been saying. He deceives the whole world. That's why this world is so dangerous. As Paul said to Timothy, perilous times are here. Verse 12, here in Revelation 12, it says, "Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time." Satan is filled with wrath. He knows his time is about up. That's why we see all of these appalling atrocities, all of these horrific nightmare scenarios playing out in Nigeria, in Cameroon, in Kenya, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, in Egypt, in France, in London, in Madrid, and on and on and on and on it goes. Where will it stop? How will it stop? Well, it's going to stop when God's government, when God's family government is set up and established on this earth. Jesus said to us, "Pray, pray that thy kingdom would come. Pray for God's kingdom to come, for God's kingdom to be established on this earth." Jesus, after all, was born to be king, as he said in Luke 1, as he told Pilate even. Jesus was born to rule this earth. Now, he came the first time to sacrifice all. He was a lamb slain from the foundation of this world. But as so many prophecies of God bring out, he's returning to this earth, and soon, to stop the madness, to end the violence, to bring peace and prosperity to everyone on earth. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, where our headquarters campus is located. You can also listen to this broadcast and any others on KPCG. Online, you can stream it online at kpcg.fm. Send us your email, your feedback, to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Well, if there's problems on the campuses of America, on the university campuses of America, you can be sure that Victor Davis Hanson is going to be right on top of it. His latest piece, I read from one yesterday, But this latest one, the university gone feral, he talks about some of what happened last week. The assumed impoverished black student at the University of Missouri, who went on a hunger strike to protest white privilege, was raised in plentitude as the son of a multimillionaire corporate executive. It says the young woman who yelled obscenities at Yale over Halloween costumes is likewise a child of privilege. Campus outbursts reveal more about the anxieties and neuroses of the adolescent and pampered than about existential issues of hunger, violence, or bias. He says here in this piece that all of these protests, it reveals more about the youths and the problem with education. It's an excellent article, by the way. I won't quote any more from it, but all throughout, he just shows how, well, just how the university life and the education has descended into darkness. Yesterday, I went through that piece on this charter school, this Eva Moskowitz, the chief executive of Success Academy Charter. And she was explaining in an article she wrote recently for the Wall Street Journal, she was explaining some of the methods that her schools use. And she said it's really quite simple. I learned what I put into practice here from my mentor. She said his students had to sit with hands clasped and look at who was speaking. They couldn't stare off into space or play with objects or rest their head on their hands in boredom. They had to go to school to learn. They had to demonstrate, these students, they had to demonstrate that for every single moment of the class, they were focused. They were made to listen, in other words, to pay attention. And her schools have generated huge results, positive results. She says Success Academy, in large measure, uses Paul's approach. This is her mentor. And that is much of the reason why we have schools where more than 95% of the students pass the state math tests in neighborhoods where, on average, fewer than 20% of students do. So even in these troubled areas, these troubled neighborhoods, her students are far outperforming those of other schools. I mentioned in the first segment that statement Paul made to Timothy about the perilous times that we're in. Let me just take you through the next verse after that. This is 2 Timothy 3, really that whole article in the Wall Street Journal by this woman, Eva Moskowitz, talking about the way her schools operate. In reading it, it made me think of some of the things we go through in marriage and family, a class that we offer at Armstrong College, and just how important it is to train up children in the way that they should go. As I said yesterday, it's not just that all this responsibility falls on school teachers and administrators at school, but it's before that, it's the parents that are preparing those little ones to listen in the classroom environment, to listen and to follow instructions, to pay attention. It says in 2 Timothy 3, beginning in verse 1, "This know also that in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy." In the last days, these perilous times, It said, men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, and disobedient to parents. Disobedience, disrespect, lack of discipline. Someone comes along and installs a program based upon discipline and order and listening and following instructions. And lo and behold, there's positive results. I've mentioned this example in class a few times about George Washington, America's greatest president, many believe, and a man of upstanding character. It's been said that when Washington's mother was asked how she raised such a remarkable son, she said, I taught him to obey, quite simply. I taught him to obey. His father is reported to have said, it's not sufficient just to obey, but to learn to obey cheerfully. So young George was brought up in a pretty good environment where he was taught how to listen, how to pay attention, how to stay focused. He was taught the Ten Commandments. He was taught to obey the Appleby Rules of Conduct, this lengthy list of virtues that went into quite a few specifics for a young boy. More detail than is there in the Ten Commandments. Associate yourselves with persons of good character. That was one of the rules, one of the virtues on the list. When you speak of God or His attributes, let it be seriously and with reverence. Let your recreations be manful and not sinful. Do not reprove or correct another in anger. Let your conversation be without malice or envy. A lot of these principles, of course, they're rooted in well-known Bible verses. And then there's this one. Be attentive when others speak. Listen. Listen to people, particularly your elders, particularly your teachers. It says, when your elders are talking, speak not until you are asked a question. Then stand up and answer. Now think about what it says. Again, in the Bible, Ephesians chapter 6 has a fair bit to say here to parents. Talks a lot about family living. But again, these are basics in Christian living, in Bible principles, God's way of life. Ephesians 6 and verse 1, children, it says, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Obey. That means hearken to their commands. That's where children first learn to submit to authority. That's where they first learn about obedience, about how to listen, about how to pay attention. It's in the home. There's a proverb that says, my son, hear the instruction of your father and forsake not the law of your mother. Hear what your father says. Of course, all of this implies that there's an active, engaged father who's there teaching in love, setting an example, showing the way. Colossians 3:20, that's another one. You can just jot some of these down and look at them later if you like. I'll finish off here with just a couple more verses in Ephesians. But Colossians 3 is a companion chapter to Ephesians 6 here. It says, children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. Let me read to you what it says in our Ten Commandments booklet. It says, because of his total lack of experience and judgment, it's absolutely necessary that a child be taught to obey his parents instantly and without question. Explanations and reasons for this may and should be given to the child from time to time, but at the moment a parental command is given, there may not be time or opportunity to give the reason why. And again, to someone that's not familiar with our teachings, this can seem, well, much like some of that teacher's policies and principles at that charter school. Too hard or difficult or extreme. But think about a little 3 or 4 year old child that's been taught to obey, to honor the parents, to listen to her elders, to listen to the teachers. Staying in Ephesians 6 here, Paul continues in verse 2. It says, honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with promise. Honor them. You parents, be honorable. And if they're honoring God the Father, they will be. They'll make their mistakes. They'll have their missteps. But if a father and a mother are submitted to God the Father in heaven, then they will, as the proverb says, train up the child in the way that he should go. What a promise, though, this is. The first commandment with promise, the Bible says. That's because if, as a child, you learn to obey those in authority, and you don't see much of this at all on college campuses today, that's why you have these spoiled brats waving their fingers in the faces of professors. That's why you have these spoiled brats denouncing the system as unfair, crying out against those who are supposedly privileged, even as they're the most privileged of all. In The Plain Truth About Child Rearing, this is an old booklet produced by the Worldwide Church of God. It says, remember, one of the great lessons any of us can learn is a deep inner sense of respect for authority. That's one of the great lessons any of us can learn. And so this woman's mentor, going back to this article I read to you yesterday and a bit from today, he'd come in, he'd expect them to listen. He'd expect them to look him in the eye. He'd expect for them to speak up and to give answers. And the critics howl. The critics say, oh, this is too strict. You're coming on too hard. And what did this woman say about that man and his example? The children loved him. The children loved being in his class. The children loved the fact that he cared about them, that he cared about their education, that he cared about their success, that he cared about their growth, their progress. That's a great lesson that any of us can learn. That's a great lesson for our children to learn early on, that deep inner sense of respect, respect for authority. It says, children should be taught to look up to the office and authority of their parents. The child who truly loves his parents will be able to experience an even fuller life if he is also taught a deep inner sense of respect toward his parents. Yes, indeed. What a full life there will be for a young person who's learned this lesson early on. What blessings, what promises, the first commandment with promise. And it goes on and says here in verse 3 that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. Here is a definite promise. Obedience to the fifth commandment. It automatically results in building habits, good habits, of fine character that leads to blessings, prosperity, long life even. And ultimately, if that obedience and honor just transfers over to our spiritual father. You talk about promises of long life, of longevity, of blessings, of prosperity. You put it in the terms of God's kingdom, and it just goes on and on and on. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. Today is Wednesday. That means at the top of the hour, you have the Trumpet Hour coming up here in just a few minutes. I'll be anxious to hear what Joel Hilliker and some of those he interviews on the program today have to say about all of the dramatic events that have been unfolding in your world. That's the Trumpet Hour at the top of the hour, just in a few minutes. Thank you for joining us today. We'll look forward to talking to you again tomorrow.